I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. The Battle of Gettysburg was the bloodiest in the Civil War, with more than 50,000 Union and Confederate soldiers who died or were wounded or captured or were missing over a three-day period 150 years ago. Our guest, Alan Gelzo, knows the terrain at Gettysburg very well as a professor of the Civil War era and director of Civil War era studies at Gettysburg College. His two books about President Lincoln both won the Lincoln Prize. His new book, simply titled Gettysburg, gives readers a moment-by-moment account of those 3 days, the politics and personalities of the military leaders, the important role the junior officers played in the chaos and confusion of war, the carnage of the battlefield, and the technology and tactics used by both sides. And Alan Gelzo has been a guest on Radio Times talking about President Lincoln, the Lincoln-Douglas debates, and Gettysburg, and we welcome him back to the show. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back, Marty.
So did soldiers and military leaders fighting at Gettysburg, did they know how significant this battle was or would become?
On both sides. Both of them realized that this was going to be a high-stakes encounter. For the Confederates, the war had been going into its third summer now, and the commander of the Confederate Army, Robert E. Lee, knew probably better than any other Southern leader that the Confederacy could not go a long distance. It didn't have the resources to support a long war. It needed to move quickly, or at least as quickly as possible, onto northern soil, win a battle there, get the knockdown in the first three rounds, so to speak, and force the northern public to demand an end to the fighting. So what he was looking for was a military victory, but he was looking ultimately for a political solution.
He wanted to negotiate, I mean, in a sense, to attack Gettysburg so he could negotiate with the North?
Sure. If he won a victory on northern soil, in fact, if all he did was for 4 or 5 months in 1863 simply lead the Army of the Potomac, the Union Army, a merry chase around Pennsylvania, that even that would have serious political consequences for the Lincoln administration, because in the summer of 1863, the Lincoln administration is in serious political trouble. And the feeling was that if we could just push hard enough, Northerners are so sick of this war and its apparent bog down that they'll demand that negotiations be opened, and Lincoln will either have to conduct those negotiations or he'll have to resign. And once the negotiations are opened, no one's really going to start shooting again.
And was Lee emboldened because of victories at the Second Bull Run, at Fredericksburg, at Chancellorsville? I mean, they had had a string of victories against the Union Army.
Not only a string of victories, but a string of victories against every expectation and against the most daunting odds, especially just 2 months before at Chancellorsville, where Lee had, in fact, he had not had his whole army present, and nevertheless, even with one arm tied behind his back, he still manages to inflict an absolutely humiliating defeat on the Army of the Potomac.
Well, in fact, as you describe, and as we know from history, Lincoln was frustrated with McClellan, but I guess refused to fire him until he eventually did. And there he had to deal with the McClellanites, and there was a lot of politics, it seemed, in who would be leading the Union Army.
Oh, goodness, yes. This was a very political war, for one thing. But for another thing, the military, our view of generals, our view of the military is today, strict subordination to civilian authority. That's simply taken as an automatic given. And wasn't really quite set so deeply in concrete in 1863. George McClellan had been called to Washington in 1861. He created the Army of the Potomac out of almost nothing and stamped it with his personality and put his favorites into command positions. He was 180 degrees opposed to the Lincoln administration's policies. He felt, as a Philadelphia Democrat, that the Lincoln administration and the radical Republicans were as much responsible for the Civil War as the secessionists were. And the best thing that could happen would be that moderate-thinking, right-thinking, peace-oriented people like himself would finally get both sides together and they'd talk this whole thing out.
Well, he even went so far as to call President Lincoln the original gorilla, an idiot. I'm thinking of Stanley McChrystal, you know, got fired for some slightly disrespectful words for President Obama, but nothing like the original gorilla.
Oh, no. And, you know, the curious thing is that McClellan not only talked in disparaging terms very freely about Lincoln, he snubbed Lincoln in public. And what was worse, after the Battle of Antietam, there was some fairly serious consideration going on as to whether McClellan ought to take matters in his own hands, use the Army of the Potomac, and stage some kind of military intervention, not in Richmond, but in Washington.
Wow.
So given that circumstance, McClellan had come almost as close to intervening in the civilian government as any military figure had ever done. And one reason why Lincoln drags his feet so long in firing McClellan is that he can't take the risk that, in fact, that might drive the Army of the Potomac to make McClellan into some proconsul or temporary dictator.
Well, he does tap General Meade, and he's, as you describe, you know, 47 years old, pretty inexperienced when it came to commanding a military, and I think he was tapped just several days before the Battle of Gettysburg.
Well, this is true. I mean, he's inexperienced, I suppose, by professional standards today. Of course, in 1863, just about all of these generals were what we would call inexperienced. Even the ones who were graduates of West Point had been trained as engineers, not combat officers. There were no courses at West Point on combat, on strategy, on tactics. It was all about how to build fortifications. And the experience of most of these officers, like Meade, had been peacetime experience. Meade had been in the Mexican War, but only as a staff officer, and his greatest military monuments were five lighthouses that he built along the Atlantic seaboard. And in fact, when the war broke out, he was in charge of the Great Lakes Survey. He was really surveying the coastlines of the Great Lakes. As far as military action, he had seen comparatively little.
And why was he called or nicknamed Old Snapping Turtle?
Oh, my. He had a hair trigger temper.
Really?
When you met George Meade, two things struck you. First, he was very dignified. I mean, here's a Philadelphia upper crust Society Hill, before it was called Society Hill, Philadelphian. And when you met him, people said, well, it was like being introduced to a Presbyterian clergyman. You know, very distinguished, very, very lofty. And he was very nearsighted, too. So he always had this pince-nez hook to the uniform jacket in front of, on the buttons on the front of his coat. But if you got him when he was mad, oh boy, he could hose you down in the verbal equivalent of napalm. And people talked about Meade's incredible temper. Just trigger it, and you would be a very sorry person indeed. He would call you out in the most extraordinary language. There are moments, in fact, when he actually takes out after soldiers who are disobeying orders as he sees. He'll get down off his horse, and he'll slug them.
Wow.
So it's the kind of behavior that almost make George Patton turn pale.
But did that help hold the Union Army together?
Well, he felt that it did. He was contemptuous of most of the Union Army because he thought of himself as a professional soldier. Most of the Union Army and the Confederate Army, too, were made up of volunteers, which is a separate category, kind of an interim category, between the state militias, what we today would call the National Guard, and the regular army. And the volunteers were kind of a mix of both. They had very little in the way of experience. Their officers sometimes had to give orders on the drill ground, reading them out of the tactics books.
Well.
And it was sort of like, if you can imagine this, it was sort of like the chaos that you'd find in summer band camp, you know, when the ninth graders are getting introduced to a marching band for the first time. So you have an atmosphere like that, even though this is a war. Well, Meade looked at these people, and it just infuriated him. Their behavior was so sloppy, so undisciplined. His professional, aristocratic instincts rose up and denounced them.
You describe, as the Southern troops come over the border into Pennsylvania, the kind of, I guess, I don't know if we should be surprised by this or not, but the ransacking of barns for food, I guess provisions for the military. Also capturing, I guess, freed blacks who were living in Pennsylvania and taking them back south sale.
It was something of a given in the 19th century that armies on the march like this would forage, they would loot, they would take whatever was not nailed down. In fact, it's not just armies in the 19th century. If you look carefully at behavior of soldiers in the 20th century, it's not really all that different. But in Lee's case, there were two things that were driving this. One is the fact that Lee had cut himself off from his nearest supply base, which was all the way back in Virginia. So his army really needed to feast off the bounty of Pennsylvania. But the other thing is this matter of kidnapping free black people in south central Pennsylvania. Ahead of the Confederate invasion, the vast majority of black people in southern and central Pennsylvania simply lit out for parts unknown. They would go north, they would go east, anywhere to get away. Those who did not, for whatever reason, were prey to be kidnapped by Confederate soldiers, rounded up, and marched off to Richmond to be sold in the slave markets. And the estimates are that perhaps 500 such people were enslaved. We have no trace of what happened to them. We don't know. They sort of just disappear off the pages of history. And I think one of the saddest blots on the record of the Confederate Army this way is its involvement in kidnapping and enslaving people in Pennsylvania.
Was that a direct order from General Lee himself, or was it more his troops sort of taking matters or the law into their own hands? Do we know?
Lee actually wrote two general orders governing the behavior of his troops, both of which had very stringent rules about paying for goods that were taken. Of course, the pay was going to be made in Confederate money, which was worthless. But at least there was some structure that way. He never mentioned anything about slaves. Yet those orders were issued, I mean, first of all, more with a view towards Lee's anxiety about the discipline of his men and keeping them in order. But secondly, they're mostly ignored in practice. And for that reason, the southern Pennsylvania countryside simply becomes great pickings for Confederate soldiers. People who objected to this, or other officers who objected to other officers that this was not in accordance with Lee's orders, got answers similar to that offered by one Confederate officer who, when it was discovered that his camp had a lot of sheepskins lying around on it, you know, his response was, well, no sheep can bite one of my men without consequences.
Wow.
So, yeah, there were all kinds of interesting excuses that could be offered, but the prime excuse is going to be the one that's offered for enslaving black people, and that is because black people are a valuable chattel commodity, and a lot of money can be earned from enslaving black people and selling them on those slave markets in Virginia.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is historian Alan Gelzo. He's the author of a new book. It's called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion, and it is about the three-day battle in the U.S. Civil War that took place in Gettysburg. We'll be talking about some of the tactics, some of the personalities and politics of this war, and, of course, that battle. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-9499. WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Alfredo Corchado, who spent years covering the violence of drug cartels in Mexico. Once at a restaurant in Laredo, Texas, two young men came in with a warning.
One of them takes his hand out and points at me and does like he was using a gun, bam, bam, bam.
Corchado's new memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Next time in Studio 360, the Civil War battle that's still going on.
I wish I...
People now are denied the use of the song because the politically correct say that it's offensive.
The never-ending fight over the song Dixie.
Look away,
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about Gettysburg, the place and the book. The book is authored by our guest, Alan Gelzo, called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. He's the Henry H. Luce Professor of the Civil War Era and Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College, this year marking the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. I should add that our guest is speaking at the Union League in Philadelphia tonight at 6:30. Obviously, you can call him by picking up the phone and dialing 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There are certain things that I think I will never understand, and one is why soldiers will walk into a hail of bullets. And clearly, when you look at these or read about these 3 days, in many ways, that's what they were doing.
Yeah, that's a question that I get asked probably more frequently than any other, and that is, why did they fight the way they did, standing up straight on the battlefield and in bunched together in these rows upon rows, firing and conducting firing drill like it was a parade ground? I mean, what sense does that make? Look, if you're on a battlefield, you want to run for cover, don't you? You want to hide behind rocks and trees, just like those Minutemen at Lexington and Concord. Well, that may be the impulse of the civilian soldier, but that's not really a particularly good idea in terms of 19th century combat. I mean, for one thing, 19th century combat's very, very different from what we see in the movies or what you might have read about in books about World War II or even experienced if you were a member of the armed services in the Iraq War or the Gulf War. In the 19th century, combat was more like a very slow-moving ballet in which large clumps of individuals maneuver very slowly across comparatively small battlefields to get into contact with each other. The weapons technology, it was an improvement, let's say, on the 18th century, because most of the armies are equipped with rifled muskets. But the rifle musket, yeah, it was an improvement, but it was not that much of an improvement. And it was still a single-shot, muzzle-loading, black powder weapon that kicked out these huge banks of smoke. So whatever improvements there were in terms of accuracy or range by the rifle musket, they're rendered nugatory by the fact that you can't see what you're shooting. Wow. After a volley or two, the powder smoke becomes so thick that it almost blots out the sun. And there's plenty of stories about soldiers in the midst of combat here actually having to get down on their knees to look under the fog bank to see where the enemy was. So it actually made perfect sense to stand up on a battlefield. You could do so with reasonable amounts of safety and to bunch people together, because accuracy is not the long suit of these weapons. What you have to do is to deliver fire by volume, not by unit. And you're trying, so that means you want to try and pull together as many people as possible in the smallest space to deliver the biggest possible wallop.
And of course, there are the cannons as well. I don't know how accurate they were, but clearly, if they hit their target, it would be pretty disastrous.
They had their limitations as well. Even artillery in the Civil War, these are still direct sight weapons, and their ranges are comparatively limited. We're not talking anything like modern artillery with forward observers and things like that. This is all direct sight, and it usually depended, in most circumstances, on the distance of the enemy, what kind of ordnance you'd be firing at them. At long distance, you would use shrapnel and shell. At middle distance, you would use solid shot, which would be a little bit like bowling cast iron bowling balls at an oncoming enemy. And then finally, the panic button mode was canister. Now, when you went to canister, that meant, uh-oh, we are in deep yogurt. We're going to have to do something desperate here, so let's fire canister. But that's the way that artillery was used in the 19th century, and even that had its limitations in terms of its real power to do destruction. Most of what artillery is going to do is not anti-personnel. It's going to be disrupt the enemy's infantry formations, make them slow down, encourage them to go to ground, because if they stop moving, they probably won't get moving again.
One of the arguments you make in your book, and I guess there are some that are saying that the Gettysburg, the Battle of Gettysburg, was the first sort of modern battle, and you're saying no. This is 19th century warfare. This is not modern warfare.
I think a civil war is probably more like the last Napoleonic war than it is the first modern war. And I honestly think the best testimony to that fact is in Gettysburg itself, in the town. I remember sitting with my wife in the Pizza Hut on Buford Avenue one beautiful autumn afternoon, late afternoon, looking up at the sunset flaming behind the seminary building on Seminary Ridge, which was fought over during the war. Beautiful photograph, but the thought came into my mind, why is that still there? Uh-huh. Why wasn't that absolutely blown to bits during the battle? Because so much fighting took place right around it. And the answer was that these weapons, as much damage as they could do to the human anatomy, really didn't have a whole lot of destructive power beyond that. And they could hit buildings, they could shave buildings, they could pockmark buildings, but they didn't have the power to knock them down. So the kind of destructiveness that we associate with total war simply wasn't in the cards. They didn't have the technology to accomplish it, even if they had wanted to.
You also write, and this is interesting, and if you go out to Gettysburg, you see a lot of these post and rail fences, that this was a problem for the South, for the Confederacy, in trying to, I guess, navigate through Gettysburg.
One of the great things about living part-time in Gettysburg, as I do, because I'm kind of part of Philadelphia boy and part of Gettysburg boy, one of the things about being in Gettysburg is day in, day out, you get this sense of the lay of the land, what the land looks like, what kinds of things you expect to find on it. You read the accounts, you look at the period photographs, and you discover things. One thing which impressed me as I was reading about Confederate reactions to this topography in Pennsylvania were the fences. They were almost talking about the fences. And especially Pickett's Charge, the two fences lining the Emmitsburg Road. Every account worthy of the name talks about the difficulty in getting over those fences. And it suddenly struck me, why were they obsessing about this? And it came to me later that they obsessed about it because it was so unlike the features of their own homes in Virginia and North Carolina. In the southern states, you have a slave economy which functions on large-scale plantations, and therefore the kind of fencing you use around large-scale plantations of 500 acres or more is comparatively thin, and you don't see too much of it. But you move into Pennsylvania, there's no slavery. There's no large-scale agriculture like that. Everybody's got their little 50, 80, 100 acres, all fenced in, triced up, and those fences, which were in their own way, their own physical reality, a symbol of a free economy and a free state, become this monstrous problem for Confederates to negotiate on the battlefield. It's almost as though the fences themselves, as these symbols of free territory, were fighting against the Confederate Army.
And that's Alan Gelzo, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a historian of the Civil War and author of a new book called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Part of your research and part of what's interesting to read in this book are just the accounts of the soldiers fighting in this 3-day battle and just the conditions they were in. They're bedraggled.
As we were talking
during the break, just about the smell of the soldiers as obviously having been in battle for months, years.
Even in the 20th century, even accounts of American soldiers in the European theater in 1944-45, when you're living out of doors and living in the rough, hygiene takes a very low priority. But this is even more so for these soldiers, which are chronically under-equipped, underclothed. They're making up uniforms from bits and pieces of this and that. And they just don't have the same expectations. So literally, you could smell these armies before you could see them. It was that bad. And in addition, just simply to the smells of the soldiers, you also have, you're packing something on the order of 200,000 men into about 16 square miles. So take that together with their, how shall we say, normal bodily functions.
Indeed.
And then add on to that some 60,000 horses, mules, other animals that are part of the armies on the march. And what you are doing is looking at an olfactory nightmare.
You chose those words very, very carefully. Let me get, looks like Gregory from Long Beach Island to join our conversation. And Gregory, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Professor, I've always been of the opinion that if Stonewall Jackson wasn't killed in Chancellorsville, and he didn't have Ewell and Johnson as a replacement when they split the Second Corps, and the failure of Ewell and Johnson to take the high ground after the first day, do you think the outcome of the Battle of Gettysburg would have been different if it were Stonewall Jackson in that position?
Greg, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead.
That's hard to say, because Jackson could be a very dramatic and aggressive commander, and then he could also be inexplicably inert. He was a great aggressive general at Chancellorsville and at Second Bull Run. On the other hand, on the peninsula, his batting average was somewhere below the Mendoza line. He just didn't even seem to be entirely awake. And in fact, he might not have been. He might have been suffering from some kind of sleep apnea. That's at least what some people have speculated. So it's hard to predict. If Jackson had been in command, we would like to think that Jackson at his best might have kept on going. But we don't know. On the other hand, Richard Ewell, who had inherited command of most of Jackson's old corps after Chancellorsville, Dick Ewell himself was no slouch. He had conducted a very successful campaign against Winchester, Virginia, the federal outpost there, just 2 weeks before. And people were hailing his conduct there as, well, this is the new Stonewall Jackson. I think the real problem is that, first of all, Ewell's corps was exhausted after a full day's marching and fighting on July 1st. And secondly, Robert E. Lee just did not give him very clear directions. If Robert E. Lee had wanted to capture Cemetery Hill on the evening of July 1st, of all people in the world, Robert E. Lee certainly knew how to give the orders for that, but he didn't. Hmm. He gave what really reads as more like a suggestion. And Ewell looked at that, looked at the situation, and said, all right, well, if it's in my discretion, I'm going to exercise that discretion, and I guess we won't press our luck.
Gregory, thanks for the call. You can call as well, and that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You write that it was really many of the junior officers in the Union Army who held off the Confederate troops, in many ways having to act on their own instincts or deal with what was confronting them on the battlefield.
We like to write military history. And I am not, I have to say this, I am not a military historian. I actually have written on 18th century moral philosophy, 19th century religion, Abraham Lincoln and Lincoln's politics and ideas. I'm not a military historian per se. But one of the things that bothers me about a lot of military history is so often the sense you get that what you're reading is an account of two generals playing chess. And that, of course, is not what happens on the battlefield itself. Never has and doubtless never will. What you get at Gettysburg confirms that, because so much of what happens in the Battle of Gettysburg really turns on the decisions made by individual lower-level officers, sometimes all the way down just to the level of non-coms, who are looking at a situation, sizing it up, making a decision that they've got to make in the next 5, 10, 15 minutes. They can't wait for orders from on high, because with the limitations of communications technology in the 19th century, it would take a good 45 minutes to get orders down from corps level to a regiment. So these officers, people whose names sometimes we know, like Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, or more often names we don't know, like Patrick O'Rourke, George Sears Green, these are people who just look at the situation, size it up, and make the right decision at the right moment and turn on the right dime and save a situation which could very easily have been the one that pulled down the center pole of the Union Army's tent.
Well, let me quote you on Colonel Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, and you say, Little Round Top has been allowed to run away from the reality. What you seem to be saying is yes, he performed very well in defending Little Round Top and using the bayonets, you know, running down the hill to take on the Confederate forces. But the fact that he lived so long and he was the governor of Maine and the president of Bowdoin, he was allowed to kind of tell his story. And maybe with each retelling, it became more mythic. Can you respond to that?
Chamberlain was a great self-promoter. And he used his war record and improved on his war record. That doesn't mean that his war record was undeserved. It certainly was. What Chamberlain did on that late afternoon, early evening of July 2nd was a remarkable beau geste. And when you consider the fact that just a year before that, he'd been a professor of rhetoric at Bowdoin College. This is not a professional military man. It only becomes more remarkable. My objection to the cult of Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain is not that Chamberlain doesn't deserve his laurels. It's that Chamberlain's not the only one who earned exactly those same laurels. And that's why I invoke the names of Patrick O'Rourke, of Samuel Sprigg Carroll, of Alexander Webb, all through this book, because these are people who really did the very same thing, and we don't hear much about them. I can only suppose because you can only get one dramatic story per movie.
Oh, are you talking about one particular movie?
Well, I'm thinking especially of the 1993 movie Gettysburg, which was based upon Michael Shara's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Killer Angels, which itself also almost single-handedly made Chamberlain into this cult figure. Again, wonderful book. Again, Chamberlain deserves all the credit that he deserves, but he is not the only one by a long stretch.
Well, it need not be said about the confusion and chaos on the battlefield. And General Meade talks about battles often decided by accidents. And that's probably true in a lot of battles and was particularly true at Gettysburg.
Well, I think that is. There are many moments you can isolate when the difference of 15 minutes, the difference of one person doing one thing or going in one direction, really could have tipped the scale entirely. And you almost feel like the entire future of the country was trembling in the balances. That is, unfortunately, one thing which makes military history a little difficult for academic historians like myself to sit very easily beside. We like to talk in terms of long historical forces, of big picture, of causality. We like to be able to say, well, this is the inevitable trend of things. To suggest that it can all come down to the decision of one junior officer at one place on a battlefield is like squeezing the accordion entirely too tight. And yet it does happen that way. It really does. There are moments when you have the great long arc of events that is really in control. But then it's as though history suffers these moments of contraction when everything comes together and suddenly minutes become hours and the decisions of individuals become incredibly important for determining what's going to be the result the next day.
Well, we're going to take another short break and then get back to our conversation and our callers. Looks like we have callers coming in at 1-888-477-9499. And we are talking about Gettysburg. That happens to be the title of our guest, Alan Gelzo's new book, called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. Of course, this year marking the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Longwood Gardens supports WHYY. Longwood presents two evenings of Classics Under the Stars with the Philadelphia Orchestra, July 18th and 19th at 7:30. Thursday, July 18th's program includes Beethoven's Egmont Overture, Tchaikovsky's Violin Concerto, and Dvorak's Symphony No. 8. Friday, July 19th's program includes Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, Gershwin's Summertime, Strauss's Voices of Spring, and Mancini's Moon River. Limited tickets are available online at longwoodgardens.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, Democrats in Kentucky have been scrambling to find a candidate who could give Senator Mitch McConnell a run for his money. Have they found one in Kentucky's Secretary of State? Also, what role did the U.S. play in Mohamed Morsi's last days in office in Egypt? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
the rural Deep South hotbed of HIV diagnosis.
This is the same virus, but a different disease in the South, and HIV really became much more of an indicator of fragile societies.
A look at how disease, race, and identity all contribute to this deeply rooted problem in the Deep South, next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowin, again talking with Alan Gelzo, our guest. He's the Henry H. Luce Professor of the Civil War Era, also Director of Civil War Era Studies at Gettysburg College in Pennsylvania, and author of this new book called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get David from Wilmington to join us. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning.
Professor, I finished your book last week. I greatly enjoyed it. It made my visit to Gettysburg so much more revealing last week.
Great.
I have one question that really fascinated me and I learned in your book. General Garnett's body was never found after Pickett's charge, and I wondered why that was, because I did a little research and I found that his sword appeared in Baltimore about 50 years after the battle. But why was such a well-respected general never identified?
David, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
There are a number of reasons which have been offered for that. One is the suggestion that he was wearing an old blue army overcoat, and he was simply mistaken for being a Federal soldier.
Oh, wow.
Another is that he had been so badly wounded that the mutilation disguised his identity. But I think the fundamental reason that Garnett's body is not identified is for the same reason so many of these others were not identified. The Union and Confederate armies evacuate Gettysburg almost entirely by the 6th of July. And at that point, the burial details are going to work. And their mandate is quick, because this is July, and they don't have a large store of ice. And they've got to get underground as many as 9,000 human bodies decomposing in the July heat, not to mention the 6,000 or 7,000 horses and mules that have been killed during the battle. And they're not really paying a whole lot of attention to the identities of soldiers. They will bury 20 and 30 people in a trench with no more marking or no more identity than 10 rebels, 20 rebels buried here. Now, in the years after the battle, especially in the 1870s, there were a lot of exhumations of Confederate dead on the battlefield. But even that tended to be very uneven. And I have to tell people that when they come to Gettysburg and they talk about hallowed ground, they have to mean that sometimes more literally than they're realizing. I can take you to some parts in the battlefield that are really still burial pits, where
you can
Confederate
see that.
Yeah, where Confederate dead were never really exhumed. And sometimes you can identify these pits fairly easily. Some, such as on Oak Ridge, where so many of Alfred Iverson's North Carolinians were buried, they were never exhumed. The bodies were never located. They're still there. And that is when you sober up in a real hurry and realize that the ground you're standing on is really, it's not just a battlefield, it's a graveyard.
Thanks for the call, David. Why didn't General Meade pursue the Confederate Army? The Union officially won the Battle of Gettysburg. Of course, it took almost 2 years before the war was actually over. But why didn't he pursue?
That, I think, may be the single most annoying, nagging, and ultimately profound question about the Battle of Gettysburg. Why didn't Meade follow up? The Confederate Army had been very badly handled. It was an army which had lost almost a third of its strength over 3 days. And what was more, when it retreated back through Maryland to the Potomac River, the rains of that month, and that was an extremely rainy summer, the Potomac River was at flood stage. Federal cavalry raiding had destroyed the one pontoon bridge that had been built there. And Lee's army was really backed up against the Potomac with nowhere to go. Why didn't Meade close in and deliver the final punch? Well, Meade's reasoning was this. Well, the Confederate Army, yes, has been badly handled, but so has mine. You know, it's disorganized. It suffered enormous casualties. There's been tremendous bloodletting. I can throw away this victory by an unadvised, premature attempt to stamp on the Confederates, because the Confederates are perfectly capable of turning like a badger in a barrel. So when you treat a wounded animal respectfully, you're doing something of the same thing that George Meade is doing. And yet there's always been this really annoying sense that George Meade is pulling his punches for more reasons than just prudence. George Meade is a McClellanite. He is not in sympathy with the Lincoln administration. He owed his brigadier stars back in 1861 to George McClellan. He has remained in correspondence with McClellan. Look, they're both Philadelphians from the same neighborhood.
Yeah.
And his politics are 180 degrees, like McClellan's, from the Lincoln administration. And there has been some speculation that, in fact, Meade was really, like McClellan, reluctant to win a clear-cut stand-up victory because that would be handing a present to Lincoln and the radical Republicans. And did he really want to do that? Lincoln, of course, was beside himself because he saw this as the opportunity to end the war. He actually sends direct orders to Meade to attack. Meade instead calls a council of his corps commanders and says, well, you know, the opinion of my corps commanders is, you know, this is not a good idea. And the result of it is that Lee does manage to escape across the river. Lincoln was not an emotional man, Marty, but when he heard that, he was just outraged, and he said to his Secretary of the Navy, there is bad faith somewhere, Mr. Wells. There is bad faith.
But that prolonged the war, do you think, the fact that Meade did not
for another 21 months, yes.
Really?
I mean, if the Army of Northern Virginia had been destroyed at Williamsport, Maryland, with its back against the Potomac, that would have, if not within 6 weeks, then certainly within 6 months, have spelled the end of the Confederacy, because there would have been no Confederate army worthy of the name to protect the Confederacy in the East.
Let me get back to our callers. It looks like we have Stephen calling us from Philadelphia. And Stephen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Earlier you had suggested that if Lee had prevailed, he might have been able to use that victory for a political victory by influencing the people of the North. But I'm asking, in view of the fact of the Emancipation Proclamation and Grant taking Vicksburg and in effect dividing the Confederacy into two, that even if Lee had won at Gettysburg, he would have been so damaged, have lost so much in the way of troops, and Lincoln could have increased his enlistment of black soldiers, that any campaign by Lee in Pennsylvania really would not have been fruitful. And with the Emancipation Proclamation, the South lost all chance of either England or France giving any political support to it.
Stephen, thanks for the call. What do you think?
Well, we move into the realm of what-ifs, which is always a perilous territory to maneuver in for
But interesting to speculate.
But always fun. Always fun. Let me put it this way. If Lee had won, it simply would not have been a matter just of a victory in Pennsylvania. Grant takes the last Confederate citadel in the Mississippi River, Vicksburg, on the 4th of July.
Same time, essentially.
What exactly, though, did he gain by that? Well, he gained the opening of the Mississippi River. That didn't actually split the Confederacy, because the Trans-Mississippi had really not been all that strategically significant to the Confederacy anyway. If it really had been, then the war would have ended in a good deal less than 21 months. Actually, what the opening of the Mississippi does is more political for Lincoln in the North, because it helps to pacify anti-war sentiment in the upper Midwest. The upper Midwestern farmers had lost their markets in New Orleans back in 1861. Well, now, with the fall of Vicksburg, that's going to reverse itself. Actually, militarily, Ulysses S. Grant afterwards then has to go back up into Tennessee and really start all over again from where he had been in 1862 and follow what really was the real line of military operations in the Confederacy, and that was the line that stretches from Chattanooga to Savannah. So Vicksburg does not really weigh as heavily in the military balances the way Gettysburg does. It's a political victory more than it is a military one. As for the Emancipation Proclamation, the black troops who were being recruited were still, in 1863, very early on in the stages of being enlisted, mustered in, organized, and put into place. There were no black units, for instance, in the Army of the Potomac at Gettysburg in July of 1863. Would the Emancipation Proclamation have made all that much difference? Well, if Lee had been victorious at Gettysburg, the Army of the Potomac, and this at least is the testimony of soldiers in the Army of the Potomac, would probably have disintegrated. Its morale was in such critical state that large parts of it probably would simply have walked away.
So many losses leading
up
to...
Exactly. I mean, that nearly happened after Fredericksburg, and it would probably have happened now with Gettysburg. Now, unite that to the fact that 10 days after the Battle of Gettysburg, the city of New York erupts in these massive draft riots, which are really riots, not just about the draft. These are really race riots. And not only New York, but Boston, Toledo, many points across the country. If the Confederate Army had been victorious at Gettysburg, and then this is followed by the uprisings in New York City and in Boston, well, people on the ground then, like, for instance, Richard Henry Dana in Boston, Dana said if Lee had been victorious at Gettysburg, then every anti-Lincoln copperhead, every white supremacist, everyone resisting it would have risen up. They would have paralyzed the North politically. The governor of New York and the governor of New Jersey were anti-Lincolnites. They would have demanded this end of the war. Yes, it would have been one military victory in the middle of Pennsylvania, but the ramifications of it would have been enormous. And if we had gone to negotiations after Gettysburg with the Confederacy, don't imagine for a minute that the Emancipation Proclamation would have stood in the way of Southern slave owners demanding the rendition of their runaway slaves. After the Revolution, after the War of 1812, they did it, and the federal government supported it. And I don't think that we should pay any compliments to Southern slaveholders, or for that matter to Northern racists in 1863, by thinking that the Emancipation Proclamation would have stood in the way of people in the midst of negotiations with an independent Confederacy surrendering black people to the chains and irons held by their former masters.
Stephen, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me throw something else out here, and you include a number of articles written at the time of people coming back to Gettysburg. This would be the civilian population. And one that caught my eye was the fact that some people were, I guess, charging the government a lot of money for renting out their homes or losing property. It's sort of an interesting little nugget of history, it seems.
Picture this. You are a soldier which has just survived these 3 days of battle, and the civilians of Gettysburg are coming out of their cellars, or they're coming from wherever they were hiding in the countryside, and they want to start charging you a quarter for a glass of water. And you're thinking, wait a minute, we just fought this 3-day battle to save your backs. What are you doing charging these outrageous rates? And that created this sense that the people of Gettysburg were simply a collection of mercenary sharpies who had no use whatsoever and just didn't care about the soldiers. On the other hand, think the other way. I mean, these were people who had their businesses and their farms destroyed. They were facing penury, hunger, maybe even starvation. So they were trying to get a little something that they could live on. Between those two, there's not a whole lot of empathy and communication.
Let me see what Jeff from Newtown has to say. Jeff, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you for taking my telephone call.
You're very welcome, Jeff.
And this is a particularly interesting program.
Thank you.
I called to ask for Professor Gelso's insights and comments on prior and current battlefield preservation efforts, as well as what else he would like to see accomplished preservation-wise in the future. Also, yeah. Professor, do you have any suggestions that might enhance the current visitor experience? Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff, for calling into Radio Times. In terms of preservation, is there more to preserve at Gettysburg?
Well, yes, there are. There are places on the battlefield which are actually still in private hands. The National Park Service continues to work quite diligently at securing agreements that will eventually move that property into federal oversight. And I think that the Park Service has done a just a marvelous job in its preservation and the overall upkeep of Gettysburg. You can wander around in Gettysburg, you're going to get to see almost exactly the same things those soldiers saw in 1863. And I think the job that Bob Kirby, as superintendent, has done has simply been amazing. So that, together with the work of the Gettysburg Foundation under Joanne Hanley and so many other people in Gettysburg, have really made Gettysburg the epicenter of Civil War interests. My feeling is that whatever we can preserve, let us preserve it. I am not an expert on preservation. This is one of the problems of being a history person. You know more about 1863 than you know about 2013.
But you live there.
But I live there, and I'm all for the preservation when we can hold on to these tangible pieces of our history.
And about 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, as we look back at, and I should say at the very end of your book, and you've written Lincoln books, you call him the tall one. How come?
Well, I was waxing poetic at the end.
Oh, were you?
That was a little indulgence I gave myself. But it's also, in a way, a certain homage to, I suppose, the Civil War authors had the biggest impact on me, and that is Bruce Catton. Bruce Catton wrote tremendous pieces of work on the Civil War. He was not an academic historian. In fact, he never actually finished college. But as a journalist, he wrote in ways that are so evocative, so beautiful, wonderful arching sentences, as spare as a Charles Ives symphony. And in the conclusion of his book, describing Gettysburg and the Gettysburg Address, he speaks of Lincoln as the tall man. And I thought, this is my opportunity to tip the hat to Bruce Catton.
Well, Alan Gelso, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Marty, it was a real joy.
A joy for us as well. The book is called Gettysburg, The Last Invasion. And again, our guest is a professor of the Civil War era at Gettysburg College in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Nick Sessler, our intern, Kevin Griffin, the engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.